You know, to get ready for today, I went down a bit of a history rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah.
I was reading up on Alexander the Great, specifically that moment in 333 BC in Gordium.
Ah, the legend of the Gordian knot.
It really is. The setup is just so perfect for where we are right now. We have this ox cart, it's tied to a post with this impossibly complex knot.
Made of Cornell bark and with no ends visible.
Exactly, no ends. And the prophecy was whoever could untie it would rule all of Asia.
And people have been trying for what, centuries? Just pulling at it, getting nowhere.
Getting absolutely nowhere. Then Alexander shows up, he looks at it, and you can just imagine him realizing, you know, that playing by the rules of the knot is a losing game.
So he changes the game.
He does. He draws his sword and just whack, slices right through it, the knot falls apart.
The ultimate example of lateral thinking. Or, you know, brute force, depending on who you ask.
And then the reason I can't get that image out of my head is that here we are, Friday, February 13th, 2026. And looking at the stack of research we have for this deep dive, it feels like we're staring at the Gordian knot of our generation.
That is a very, very fitting metaphor.
This one's just made of code and international law and human creativity. It's the tangled mess of copyright and intellectual property in the age of AI.
It really is. If you look at the landscape today, it feels like everyone is pulling on a different end of a rope that just keeps getting tighter.
On one side, you have the creators, artists, writers,
The
coders.
people who make the culture. And on the other, you have the tech giants who, well, who need that culture to fuel their engines.
And the stakes couldn't be higher. We are basically looking at a tug of war that decides whether human creativity crashes and burns or if we enter some kind of new renaissance. I was looking at this legal battle matrix from the sources, and the numbers are intense.
They're pretty stark. What stood out to you?
Well, first off, fair use. I mean, that's been the bedrock of the internet for 30 years. And the data shows a 65% legal pressure rating. That sounds like the foundation is buckling.
It is. The old rules just aren't mapping cleanly onto this new tech.
Then you have artist rights sitting at an 80% civil protest level. So this isn't just lawyers in a room.
No, this is people in the streets. It's a real cultural pushback.
And the tech side. Code IP, a 90% technical challenge, we'll have to get into that, but it sounds almost impossible to solve.
It's getting there.
But the big one, the one that looks like Alexander's sword in this whole thing, the EU Act.
Holding 100% legal influence.
100%. So that's the battlefield. Our mission today is to walk through these analysis layers from the source material and figure out, are we untying this knot or are we just going to have to cut it?
I think that's the question. Let's dig in.
Okay, let's start with the core conflict. The source calls it analysis layer one, but really it's about this age of synthesis.
The age of synthesis. It's a good term because we're not in the information age anymore, where you search for things that exist. Now you. You as a machine to synthesize something new. The line between what a human creates and what a machine produces is, well, it's basically gone.
And that's where fair use gets so tangled up.
That's the economic standoff. And you really have to see both sides to get why it's so tight.
So on one side, you've got the tech giants.
Their argument is existential.
Oh!
They're basically saying if we can't access this data, this art, this text, then progress stops, full stop.
The whole thing is, we aren't copying your book to sell your book. We are reading your book to learn how to write, the transformative argument.
Exactly. They compare it to a student in a library reading Hemingway to learn how to write a concise sentence. That student doesn't pay the Hemingway estate a royalty every time they write a short sentence. They're saying their models are doing the same thing, just at a massive scale.
But then you talk to the rights holders, the artists, the writers.
And to them, it's not learning, it's looting. They're saying, you are taking the intellectual assets we spent a lifetime building, and you're using them to build a machine that's designed to replace us.
It's like borrowing a cup of sugar from your neighbor, but then using that sugar to build a robotic candy factory that puts the neighbor out of business.
That is the fear. And what we're seeing is that IP is no longer just about protecting one specific work, is being used as a weapon against technological monopoly.
It's the only shield they have left.
It is. And nowhere is that shield getting more battered than on the visual front.
Which takes us to analysis layer two and layer four, the artists versus the diffusion models. I feel like this is where the fight is the most visceral.
It is, because you can see it. It's immediate. You have to understand, these models don't have like a collage of images inside them. They learn by adding noise or static to an image until it's just chaos, and then they learn how to reverse that process perfectly.
So they learn the mathematical relationship between the word cat and the pixel patterns that make a cat.
Correct. But here's where it gets messy. Analysis Layer 4 brings up style theft. Now, historically, you couldn't copyright a style.
Right. I can paint like Picasso with cubes and blue tones, and his estate can't sue me.
Historically, yes. But the scale changes everything. A human might take years to paint like that and produce one painting a week. An AI can generate a million images in that style in an hour.
And that just destroys the market for the original artist.
It completely saturates it.
Yeah.
So the question for 2026 is, can a style now be protected by law?
It's the economy of the vibe. Do you own your vibe if a machine can replicate it perfectly? And speaking of replication, analysis layer 12, creative hallucination.
This is a fascinating area where a glitch and intent sort of meet.
Does hallucination just feel like a polite word for lying or maybe stealing?
Well, that's the whole debate. When a model spits out an image that's almost exactly a copyrighted character like, say, Mickey Mouse, but with six fingers, is that a machine error? A hallucination?
Or is it, as the legal scholars in the source are arguing, systematic fraud?
Right. If I sell a knockoff purse that's 99% a Gucci bag, I'm infringing a trademark. If an AI makes a knockoff image, the defense has always been, oh, the black box made a mistake.
But now the argument is that the glitch is the proof.
Exactly. Layer 12 suggests that glitch proves the model ingested copyrighted data and is now regurgitating it.
So if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, the model probably ate a duck.
Pretty much. And proving that eating occurred is where the countermeasures come in. Layer 8 and layer 15, the rise of invisible watermarks.
This is the spy versus spy stuff I love.
It's a full-on technical arms race. We're not talking about a signature in the corner. Creators are using steganography embedding data into the very noise of the image file.
So the human eye can't see it, but a computer can.
Yes. It's a way to prove in court, your model trained on my image, and here's the invisible digital fingerprint to prove it.
A chain of custody for creativity. Okay, so that's the visual side.
Okay.
But if we shift over to text and code, the drama is just as real. Analysis Layer 3 calls it the GitHub tragedy.
This is a huge, huge issue for developers. GitHub was supposed to be this open source community. You put your code there to help people.
It is a community garden.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then tools like Copilot came along, trained on all that open source code. So now you have a commercial tool suggesting code snippets written by indie developers who never agreed to that.
It's like everyone brought food to a potluck for free, and then one guy took all the leftovers, opened a restaurant, and started charging admission.
That's a very apt analogy. And remember, that 90% technical challenge stat, this is it. Code is functional. It's so hard to claim copyright on a small function. Developers feel like their work is being strip mined.
And this connects right to analysis layer 14 with smart writing versus human writers. Yeah. We saw this with the Hollywood strikes.
The strikes really set the stage. They established that humans need to be in the loop. But the tech keeps advancing. The fight is ongoing because the very definition of writing is changing.
It really is. Is writing typing the words, or is it prompting a machine to type the words?
And if the machine does 90% of the work, did you even write the book?
An existential question. And underneath all of this, the art, the code, is the raw material. Analysis layer 5, data governance and web scraping.
This is the fundamental question.
Yeah.
Who owns the internet?
I always thought nobody, or I guess everybody.
That was the old web. In 2026, data is the new oil. And the assumption used to be if you post something publicly, it's fair game for scraping.
But that's being challenged now.
It is. The argument is that just because it's public to see doesn't mean it's public to exploit for commercial training.
It's the difference between looking at a building and dismantling it to use the bricks for your own house.
Precisely. But, you know, it's not just about money. There's a darker side to this. Analysis Layer 6 talks about toxic data.
Right. Garbage in, garbage out.
When you scrape everything, you get everything. The hate speech, the bias, the violent content.
And cleaning that out of a data set must be a legal nightmare.
It is. If a model trained on that stuff says something defamatory, who's liable? The model's creator, the person who posted the original toxic content. The courts are still figuring that out.
And then there's layer 11, which honestly freaks me out a little bit, model inversion.
This is a serious privacy risk.
Yeah.
We think of these models as black boxes where the original data is melted down. Model inversion proves that isn't always true.
How so?
Basically a hacking technique. Researchers found that by asking a model the right questions over and over again, you can sometimes force it to reconstruct its original training data.
Wait, so the AI could accidentally reveal private patient records it was trained on?
Exactly. It can leak the secrets it was fed. It turns the AI from a vault into a screen door.
That is terrifying. Okay, so we've got toxic data, privacy leaks, style theft. The knot is very, very tight. So how do we cut it? Analysis layer 9 points to the EU.
The European Union has really stepped into the role of Alexander here. Remember that stat? The EU Act holds 100% legal influence.
Why 100%? Why does Europe get to decide for everyone?
It's the Brussels effect. The EU market is so huge, global tech companies can't afford to ignore it. So they won't build two different AIs, one for Europe and one for the US.
Ah, so the EU's rules become the default global standard.
Effectively, yes.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is forcing transparency. They're breaking the knot by saying, we don't care how magic your box is, you have to tell us exactly what went into it.
So show us your homework.
Yes. Did you use copyrighted books? Did you pay for them? This is forcing a shift mentioned in analysis layer 10, new business models. We're moving from scrape everything for free to data licensing agreements.
So paying for the data.
Imagine that. You want to trade on the New York Times archive, you pay for a license. It turns data from a wild resource into a commodity.
Which seems fair, but analysis layer 7 brings up another weird problem. What about the stuff the machine makes? Can a machine own what it creates?
This is where the law gets philosophical. And for the most part, international courts are saying no. Copyright requires a human author, a creative spark.
So if a machine makes it, it's just public domain.
In many places, yes. Which creates a paradox. Companies spend billions building machines that create things they can't actually own.
That's a bad business model.
It's a very bad business model. And it leads to the ultimate question in analysis layer 13. What does ownership even mean in a post-AI world?
It's the IKEA furniture debate. I assembled it, but I didn't design the table.
Exactly. And we are redefining work itself.
So, okay, let's bring this down to earth. I'm listening to this. I'm an artist or a writer in 2026. I'm hearing all this and I'm thinking, great, but what do I do right now?
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And our source material has a kind of survival guide.
Okay, let's run through it. First line of defense.
Use the tech against itself. We mentioned invisible watermarks. There are tools like Steg.ai. You should be using them to embed proof of ownership into your files before they ever go online.
So if your image turns up in a data set, you can prove it's yours.
Exactly. It gives you legal standing.
Okay. What if I want to play offense? I don't want them learning from my style at all.
Then you need anti-learning tools, things like Glaze or Nightshade.
Nightshade. I love that name. Sounds poisonous.
It is to the models. These tools subtly change the pixels in your image. It looks normal to a human. But to an AI, it makes your art look like something else entirely. It makes a dog look like a toaster to the computer.
You're poisoning the data well to protect your style.
You are. You're making your work inedible to the machine.
That's amazing. Okay, what about the legal side? I can't afford a team of lawyers.
No, but you can use contract clauses. Every time you sell a work, add a specific no AI trading clause. It states this work is for use, but not for machine learning.
Does that actually stop the scrapers?
It might not stop a random web scraper, but it gives you huge legal leverage if you find out a client fed your work into a model later. It defines the terms of the sale.
Smart. And last, what if I need to use AI in my own work but don't want to get sued?
Then you use safe tools. Stick to licensed models. The source mentions Adobe Firefly as a prime example.
And that's safer because.
Because it was trained on Adobe's own stock library where the rights were all cleared and paid for. It's the fair trade coffee of the AI world. It keeps you out of legal hot water.
So, Steg.ai for proof, Nightshade for defense, contract clauses for legal cover, and licensed models like Firefly for safety. That's a solid toolkit.
It is. It's about being proactive. You aren't helpless.
We've covered a lot. We started with Alexander the Great and a knot of bark, and we ended up with digital poison and invisible watermarks.
It's a brave new world.
It really is. To wrap up, the Gordian knot is being pulled tight.
Yeah.
The EU and the courts are trying to cut it, but it is messy.
It is. But I think we need to leave the listener with one final thought from analysis layer 15.
Go for it.
We talk about this as a battle for survival. And if this knot isn't untied correctly, if the tech giants just win, we're facing a massive recession in the creative industries. The value of human labor could plummet. That's the dark timeline.
There is another option.
There is. If we cut it successfully, like Alexander, if we solve the compensation model, we could enter a new era of digital flourishing, Imagine a world where artists are paid every time a machine learns from them.
The Renaissance scenario.
Exactly. The technology isn't evil. The business model is the problem. If we fix the model, we can fix the future.
So the question is, which future are we heading toward? The recession or the Renaissance?
That depends on how we handle the sword. And it depends on you, the creators, using the tools we talked about today.
A huge thank you for helping us navigate this, and a huge thank you to you, the learner, for joining us on this deep dive.
Keep questioning.
We'll see you next time.